I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The travel ban fight echoes our history from the founding. And let's admit, we all take it personally. Are refugees and migrants coming ashore to be seen as humble guests of the nation? Or as American as anyone, just for getting through the gate? George Washington said he was building an asylum for the oppressed of all nations. And so the Statue of Liberty, the mother of exiles with her worldwide welcome, she said. Kansan Kenyan Barack Obama embodied the whole dream, an America for searchers, strivers, migrants like his father. The polyglot nation of all nations, not the world's master, but the world's story. And now the counter story from the man who doubted that Obama was born American, much less that he belonged in the White House. Very quickly, 10 days after the contested travel ban on entrants from seven mostly Muslim nations of the Middle East, the image of us has shifted in the mirror that others look at. The voices here now were mostly Arab students that we met this week at a conference in Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.
So the day after the immigration ban came into effect was the first day I woke up feeling that I was not welcome in America, that I was not wanted here. And the biggest irony of that is that being in the Middle East and growing up in the Middle East, we come here for the openness. We come here because we can belong. So it was a really hard day.
It's just been extremely disheartening to see the direction that our new administration is turning in so quickly. It's almost as if they're labeling us as second-class citizens without even any nuance around it.
I started getting more concerned about what it means to stay here in the U.S. Initially, I was thinking of, after graduation, that I wanted to work for a couple of years, get more experience from the policymaking institutions within D.C. or other places in the U.S. Now my plans are shifting because I'm concerned about my family's situation if I do continue to work here in the U.S.
I think a lot of people had felt that the rhetoric that Trump was stating during the campaign may just been rhetoric and not really going to manifest itself. But I think he put us on notice, effectively, as far back as over a year ago. And I think we should have expected it and really kind of prepared ourselves. Today, it may be Arab Americans, it may be Muslim communities. Tomorrow, it may be environmental activists, LGBTQ communities. Everybody needs to be vigilant, aware, and active citizens.
Our guest, Neil Swaide, gets us started on the hometown history of an American fight that's 250 years old. You did some marvelous digging, Neil, for a long piece in the Boston Globe magazine last Sunday about a fervent anti-immigration campaign in the 1890s. It was rooted in the heart of the Boston Brahmin aristocracy as it saw its own extinction coming. And I had a spooky feeling as I read it that my family roots were tangled up in it, maybe yours too. Would you introduce these characters that would have kept certainly my family out, maybe yours?
Oh, mine as well, certainly. The leader of this pack was a guy named Prescott Hall. And here was a child of privilege.
Two last names is a giveaway, yeah.
Prescott Farnsworth Hall. If you need a more Brahmin name than that, he
had it in the middle.
Exactly. And he looked around, as a lot of Brahmins did in the late 1800s, and kind of wondered, what happened? How did our class that kind of built this nation going back to colonial days, how did we lose? They lost around here largely to the Irish. Nationally to Germans and others coming in. And rather than just whiling away his days over liquid lunches at the Somerset Club, he undertook a root cause analysis. Hmm. And he came up with this idea that it was unchecked immigration that was the ruin of this country. And he was issuing a warning to the rest of the country that it's these new immigrants coming in now. The immigration had shifted from Northern and Western Europe to Southern and Eastern Europe. And he used that to ring the alarm to the rest of the country, saying, if we don't do anything, we're going to regret this now. And what's interesting and what distinguishes him and he had two Harvard-educated colleagues, both from Mayflower families, was that they didn't just kind of wail in at the wind on this. They were able to influence the influencers. They created an early Washington think tank out of Boston that went after influential politicians and newspaper people and business leaders, and they gave them the material, the intellectual argument, to say, this isn't just us complaining about shifts in immigration patterns. This is us building a social science argument for what is going on here.
And with those usual wildly weird accusations that the immigrants were, what, 50% more criminal, double the rates of insanity among the rest, triple the rates of paupers. So keep them out at all costs. I was going to say, there's something shriveled and sad about these people, I must say. But they were determined.
They were determined. And so Prescott Hall is a fascinating guy because he's a homebody. He lives in his backyard garden in Brookline. He knows every insect and every plant that's there. He doesn't like to get out much. But with a fervor, he sits in his home study and comes up with these tracts to get out to people to explain what's happening here and why this is so dangerous. And so there's this weird kind of way that you get the sense of scapegoating that happens for their own decline and inability. In this case, many of these guys were childless, and they were arguing that the immigrants were the reason that the Brahmins were childless. It sounds preposterous, but they had a elaborate argument for it. And you do get the sense sometimes that these guys were just looking for explanations to explain their own inadequacy. But yet they were successful ultimately in really changing how this nation treated immigrants. And that to me was the biggest revelation.
The Irish folk hero and mayor, James Michael Curley, had the last line and the best line in your piece. He said, we can see the outcome of this story. He said, any good Irish family in Boston has seven or eight children, and those Brahmins have dogs.
Exactly. And, you know, here's a stunning statistic. By 1900, three-quarters of the population in Boston, in New York, in Buffalo, in Cleveland, in San Francisco, were immigrants or children of immigrants. This was a major time of dramatic change in this country, and immigration was changing the dimensions of the country, and people were unsettled by that, and people were fearful by that, some people. And like we see now, it doesn't take a whole country mindset to change around immigration. Mm-hmm. You just need to get – there's some people who are always opposed to immigration, and the nativists just need to peel off a section of the middle to bring them along, and that's where these changes can happen. And often fear is the mechanism for doing that.
They were working the Congress, and it took them till 1917 to get an Immigration Act. But I was fascinated. In the 1890s, they were passionate for a literacy test. If you couldn't read substantially in your own language or the English, you couldn't get in. It was exactly the moment that my Lydon and Hanley grandparents signed their X's, illiterate X's, on the papers that I've seen coming into Boston in 1895. Had the literacy test been there, I wouldn't be here.
Exactly. You've been doing a broadcast from Galway. And you know, my family wouldn't be here as well, too. We are all immigrants. It's just a matter of how far back you go. And that, I think, we forget a lot about. The literacy test was a proxy fight. So at that point, they got more blunt later on in these fights. But early on, they would say, we're getting undesirable immigrants, so let's equate undesirability with illiteracy, and let's make sure we're getting only literate people coming in. And that, Bill, as you pointed out, so these three Harvard guys started up this Immigration Restriction League in 1894. By 1897, both houses of Congress passed that literacy test, and it was only the veto pen of Grover Cleveland that prevented it from becoming law.
You know, not to let Livingston Farnsworth Hall or whatever off the hook entirely, there were other Brahmins at that moment who were building the Boston Public Library in Copley Square, a monument to this day to the giant Brahmin writers of the 19th century, Thoreau, Longfellow, Parkman, Emerson, the Alcotts. At the very same time, they were giving that library and a free ticket of admission to the immigrants. They saw the immigrants coming and they thought, let's throw up the monument and show them the way. The deal was, read books in this library and you'll be instant Americans and you'll be middle class in a generation, which is true.
Absolutely true. And it's a really good point that it wasn't the Brahmins in lockstep that were opposed to immigration. In some ways, Prescott Hall was fighting with his own class because there was a segment of Brahmins who benefited from immigrants coming in because they owned the mills that employed the cheap labor. And there were other Brahmins who intellectually argued with this. The president of Harvard, Eliot, at the time, was their chief foil, who was saying, you can kind of rail against immigrants, but that is intellectually suspect. And then the new president who followed him, Lowell, who has property named after him, buildings, famous buildings on the Harvard Yard campus, he became the vice president of the Immigration Restriction League. He was such an ardent nativist. So there was a battle going on through this generation within the Brahmin class.
So what's the moral for this day? I take the sense that this kind of restriction is bound to fail. It's marked by this kind of last stand of declining minority, powerful, white, 19th century immigrant stock in this case, but that there's something reassuring about the way this worked. The way this country grows is through new people, new gifts, new talents for ever-changing world.
I agree. And so I take from this deep dive through history a lesson that is both encouraging and discouraging. The encouraging part is exactly what you said. The pendulum eventually swings back. There are these periods where fear overrides other issues and the kind of nation of immigrants gets subsumed by the fear and the unsettled feeling that people have. And we eventually swing back to that. The discouraging part is it took 40 or 50 years after these guys got their big win for them to lose fully. I mean, This changed this country's complexion until the 50s and 60s.
Interesting. Neil Swaddy, don't go away. We're talking about American politics and culture in the age of Donald Trump. Coming up, the Omni historian Francis Fukuyama underlines the point that the contest between immigration nation and Fortress America is one in which there are no new ideas. It's only the names of the antagonists and the labels on the threat that are new, as they are again today. This is Open Source. Francis Fukuyama got famous a quarter century ago for a classic study with a wonderfully wrong title, The End of History, at the close of the Cold War. His reputation survives. In the struggle over immigration into America, he told me this week, history keeps curling back on itself, and it still has a long way to go.
I think that understandings of American identity have really changed over time, and Trump and Bannon are referring back to an older sense of identity that historically was unquestionably the one that was the dominant one for much of the 18th, 19th centuries. In fact, John Jay in Federalist 2 says, we are one people connected by kinship, by the same religion, having the same ancestors, having adherence to the same principles of government, meaning they were all English settlers, that had a very particular religion, which was, sectarian Protestantism. And I think that would have been the way that Americans would have characterized their national identity, for quite a while after the Revolution. Mm. I think it was only with this big wave of immigration that started in the last decade of the 19th century, the early decades of the 20th century. Yeah, that's right. Well, mine too. My grandfather came over in 1905, so You had this huge wave of people who were not English. And by the way, the original meaning of nativism was not white people. It was English Protestants attacking Irish Catholics, who had come in the 1840s after the potato famine. Mm. And they're saying, these people are really not like us. But then you have this big wave of immigration at the turn of the 20th century. And I think at that point, the sense of American identity begins to, change to this one that is much more commonly held, where identity is really about the Constitution, the rule of law, belief in democracy. It's not rooted in any specific religion or ethnic group. When you get Bannon referring to that earlier sense of identity, people get offended because that's one that became less and less tenable as the de facto diversity of the country began to increase in the 20th century.
What's the future of the argument in this country, really? Where are we going?
Well, I think that the modern understanding of identity is inevitable and it's good. You know, that you have political values that define what it means to be an American. It's not tied to religion, to ethnicity, to race. So anyone that espouses those values can be an American. And I think in the long run, that's going to be very healthy because de facto, you know, we're very multicultural. You're going to have continued migration. I mean, you can try to control it, you know, the levels, but you're still going to have a very diverse society. And I just think that's the only way that people can ultimately live together. If it has to be based on ethnicity or religion, then it's just a formula for, I think, endless discord.
What does it tell you that Steve Bannon, from the National Security Council to the Vatican, seems to be playing in harmony with the right-wing anti-Pope Francis faction of the Church that sees Christianity embattled indefinitely now with Muslims?
You know, this becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If they conceive of this as a fundamental battle, you know, the most important conflict in the world right now, you're going to make it a self-fulfilling prophecy that you'll do things that will then stimulate people on the Muslim side to continue to see this as a civilizational struggle. I mean, the whole thing we've been trying to do since September 11th is to say it's not a civilizational struggle. It's a struggle against certain radicals within the Muslim world who will be defeated ultimately by other Muslims. And to put it in civilizational terms basically is to undercut those other Muslims that, you know, whose help we need.
It's almost comical when you hear the history of peoples that have been villainized by their skin, their head shape, their religion. But of course, it's not. How do these things play out?
You know, it's very hard to tell. In Europe in the 1930s, it played out in this very just unimaginably horrible way. In other cases, there was a lot, you could write an article in a peer-reviewed social science journal in the 1920s explaining how Northern Europeans were more intelligent than Jews or Southern Europeans and certainly than various, you know, brown and black peoples. And that view was defeated, you know, in a certain sense by some good social science that showed that that simply wasn't true empirically, but more importantly by Hitler and the horror that people had of a regime that took these racial theories seriously. And that kind of immunized us for a good, you know, 2-3 generations. But people forget and, you know, it comes back. And so I think you have to keep fighting this fight in every generation.
Take a guess. Where will we be a year from now in the sense of ourselves as a nation in the world, a nation among nations?
You know, that's one of those questions that's really hard to answer. I mean, I think that you're going to get increasing polarization because you've got a president and an administration that really wants to drive that. But on the other hand, he's producing so much pushback that this could be the biggest gift ever given to the left, you know, to the progressive left in this country, because it's all of a sudden given everybody a common cause to unite around, which they really didn't have, you know, like in the Democratic primaries. So it's very hard to predict.
Francis Fukuyama watches the world and he teaches from a high perch at Stanford University. Aziz Rana joins us from Cornell University, constitutional law professor and star essayist. We love your work in N Plus One, Aziz. You feel your own American identity vibrations in ways that are complicated, and they also sound familiar. American born, of immigrants who came here to study, father from Kenya, mother from Lebanon. They met at an anti-apartheid rally in the 80s in California, wasn't it?
In the 70s.
In the 70s?
In the 70s. I'm a little older.
Aziz Rana's big book in a blooming career is The Two Faces of American Freedom. I want your take, Aziz, on whatever happened to the cosmopolitan spirit of the first Obama election in the early days. You write it was an ecstatic, fresh leap in our whole story. What brought it down?
Well, so first I think it's just useful to get a sense of that experience in 08, 09. And, you know, so Obama had a number of great political skills, but in many ways, like maybe his best political skill was how he was able to tie his own personal biography to a story about the country that, you know, a story that you referenced at the top of the show. He really embodied the American creed, the thought that the U.S. is committed from the founding to equal opportunity for all. American history is the steady inclusion of every group into this promise. And internationally, the U.S. is really the world in miniature. It's the land of the free, and so its interests are the world's interests. It's exceptional and indispensable. And I think it's actually useful to know that, so maybe this is an addendum to what Fukuyama just said, that these are views that really took off during World War II and in the early days of the Cold War. It was the heart of U.S. Cold War nationalism, the bedrock of center-left, center-right politics since the 50s, and Obama was really its pinnacle.
Exactly. But he gave more authenticity to the story, his story did, than was really plausible in real life.
Yeah, I think you can think of this as, you know, Obama's strength, but also his weakness. And I don't want to personalize this too much because I have a huge amount of respect for him and he was a generational political figure. So in a way, when we talk about weakness, we talk about the weakness of the Democratic establishment, party establishment, center-left politicians. And it's because that story, as familiar and beautiful as it is, in political practice was tied to a very specific policy vision. And it was a policy vision that basically thought our institutions are just. If there's reform that's needed, it's kind of like incremental reform on the edges. You have faith in national security experts, faith in economic experts, faith in the markets. You like mobilization at election time. You don't really like mass mobilization when it's not election time. And I think in the country, even in 08, against the backdrop of the Iraq war, the financial crisis, it had already been hard to sustain. So in this way, like, Obama was almost like the last gasp of this worldview, this vision. You know, that the country over the last decade, they faced the war in Iraq, the financial crisis, the explosion in economic inequality, problems of mass incarceration. It's been a time, frankly, of failing institutions and the experts, you know, the grown-ups in the room, the financial experts, the national security experts, they got things catastrophically wrong. And so here was the situation over the course of the last decade where Obama, who really embodied, you know, almost perfectly that kind of centrist Cold War creed, you know, and its incremental faith, was kind of confronted by really rolling social crises. And there's a basic question about whether or not the center-left really was equipped to deal with them.
How was it that Donald Trump and Steve Bannon probably saw that that story was somehow exhausted in ways that Obama and the Democrats didn't?
So I don't think it's just, you know, Bannon and Trump. I think it's really important to bring Bernie Sanders and Black Lives Matter into this. And okay. One way to tell the story of really the last year is that the Cold War, you know, the Cold War has been over since 1989. But it was only really in the last year that it was clear that the framework of Cold War politics, American exceptionalism, all the stuff that I just described, had receded. I mean, the two most significant political forces with the largest amount of enthusiasm, one was a self-avowed socialist, and the other person was a pro-Russian ethno-nationalist. This is, you know, Trump and company. And that's kind of something that's inconceivable. In a way, we had a moment where Bush and Obama probably in some domains had more in common with each other than either had with Bernie or Trump. And I think that highlighted the fact that, you know, the old way of doing business and talking about politics against the backdrop of these collapsing institutions was, you know, increasingly less able to sort of make sense of the times.
Part of the Obama, short-sightedness was abandoning his own post-colonial roots. I mean, he made himself kind of an ideal American story, but he left out what everybody was getting to know about the rest of the world. I wish you'd just, there's so many interesting consonances between your background and his, but there are big differences too. Spell them out in your worldview and his.
Yeah, I mean, so first I just want to say that, you know, I don't think that there was anything disingenuous about Obama's presentation of self and country. I think that's part of what made it so powerful. The fact that, you know, really it was absolutely true for him and he was able to crystallize those values. But, you know, I couldn't help over the last decade noticing the differences. So I have a very similar biography. I'm also half Kenyan. I've come from an interracial background. You know, I teach constitutional law.
You got a funny name.
I have a funny name. I have an ethnic name. But, you know, I've just been struck by how how different my own family's version of Americanism was than the version that he articulated.
Totally.
Also internationalist, but not really in this Cold War register. So, I grew up in a family that linked people of color here in the U.S. to those in Asia and Africa, and especially to the politics in South Africa, to the ideas that there were similar what amount to settler colonial resonances in both of these communities. And we had touchstone political figures in my home, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X. But, you know, they weren't tied to Jefferson and Washington. They were tied to people like Patrice Lumumba in the Congo.
Hmm.
And the way we thought about politics, or the way that politics came across at home, was it was about freedom, and freedom in a really transformational sense. And the terms were self-determination at home and abroad on grounds of economic democracy, anti-racism, anti-colonialism. And we were still really clearly American. I always felt myself as thoroughly American. I was born in this country. There's no other place for me. You know, there's basketball on the TV, Dylan and Coltrane on the stereo.
Hmm.
But rather than pledging allegiance to the state or to an idea of, you know, the state and the nation is the only site really of my own political affiliation, our political affiliation was a kind of transnational, frankly, third world community of concern. And just if I would add like one more thing about this, is that, you know, this didn't make me all that unusual in growing up. So I was born in December 1978. But growing up in the 80s, there were a lot of kids of color that had a similar background, that had funny names for political reasons. And it's why, while I felt a ton of pride in seeing him elected president,
mm-hmm.
I also felt mixed, because there was a way in which Obama's framing, even though I absolutely believe it was true to him, it felt like it underscored in 08, 09, yet again, how there's only one way to be a person of color and to be political and still accepted as someone that's American. You can only talk in one register.
And he probably read that right. It was maybe his only way, right?
I think that's true. I mean, I do think that there's, again, real belief in this story, and that's why he goes to it time and again. It's the centerpiece of just about every major political speech he gives. But I think he is right. I think, you know, coming of age as a political person in the Clinton and Bush years, you know, you couldn't speak in more eruptive terms. I mean, and that's in a way what distinguishes, let's say, the 90s and the 2000s and the 80s from the 60s and the 70s, when you had a much more vibrant political left that included a kind of self-consciously internationalist perspective. And even, frankly, the last couple years, where you have, you know, from Ta-Nehisi Coates to Colin Kaepernick to the politics around the Sanders campaign, kind of self-avowed effort to embrace again left politics in all of its variety.
Aziz, what part of Barack Obama's presentation of his own story explains the rise of Donald Trump?
Well, you know, so I don't know if there's a presentation that explains it, but I do think that in a sense, what happened over the last couple of years is that as that Cold War frame that Obama so beautifully captured started to fray, you know, it became apparent that that frame had constrained not just the left. So we generally think of it, oh, the Cold War was bad for the left because of McCarthyism and the blacklists and COINTELPRO. But it also really limited the right. You know, a kind of Jim Crow ideology of white nationalism was a scandal increasingly during the Cold War, because how is it that you can reach out in a battle for ideas with the Soviet Union to people in the global South if at home you're reproducing apartheid policies? It's why actually somebody like Jeff Sessions can't be, you know, appointed to a federal judgeship in 86. That even for the Republican Party, even within the terms of American politics in that period, that the creedal story has real teeth. And I think basically it's not, I don't think the rise of Trump and Bannon should be seen as a failure of the Obama administration or of the creedal story. But as that Cold War register starts to recede, you can have an unreconstructed right return, which has always, as Fukuyama noted, been incredibly powerful in American life, but it had been suppressed for various reasons. So you had to talk about it in code, and And now you don't have to talk in code on the right anymore.
Ashish Rana, I want to ask you, how many shades of American are you feeling in yourself these days under pressure from Trump politics? How's your all-American score?
I mean, it's a really interesting moment because there's no doubt that this last year has been trying in the last few months, in the sense that it's the first time in my life where it seems increasingly acceptable to speak in straightforwardly xenophobic terms, mm-hmm. and things that I assumed wouldn't be part of the country, the community that I'm part of, or again, part of that community, just like those students that you were talking to at the beginning of the hour. And so there's a kind of danger. I have relatives still in Kenya, and, you know, they wonder, are they going to be able to come and visit me? Will my dad see his grandkids? But at the same time, you know, I have to say that the last couple of years have also been really interesting, because it's been the first time when there have been political voices here on the left that are speaking in the way that my family spoke about politics at home. It's the first time that my form of Americanism seems like it's actually part of the conversation. You can see it in the Black Lives Matter movement.
Ashish Rana, we got to worry about whether you can go and visit your Kenyan cousins and get back. Don't go away. Coming up, a poet and a city councilman, newcomers of immigrant stock working in practical politics and the cauldron of culture. This is Open Source. In the new tug of war over the immigration line, fired up by President Trump's so-called travel ban, which was shot down this week in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. See you in court, the president tweeted, signaling his appeal next to our Supreme Court. The travel ban was aimed at refugees and also green card Americans from 7 mostly Muslim nations in the Middle East. Shada Dayani is an Iranian poet and translator, a PhD from NYU, now at Harvard, teaching poetry on campus that she would not be allowed to teach today in Iran. She gave us a glimpse this week of the cross currents in the mind of a Muslim artist in America these days.
Of course, you think about people around you, but at the same time, you can't lose sight of thousands and thousands of people who need to be in this country because of matters of life and death. That was the first thing that really just numbed me and paralyzed my senses. I think that we're in this together, and I feel American every time I reflect on what I do for a living and acknowledge to myself that I will not be given a chance at an Iranian university today to teach the texts that I teach in the way I teach them here. I'm given this chance here, and that's what makes me feel American. This is what makes me appreciate James Baldwin so much in these difficult times. The future of the immigrant in this country is precisely as bright or as dark as the future of the country. For me, being an American is as much a nationality as it is a state of mind that allows you to put yourself in the shoes of someone radically different from you. So when I think of myself as an American, I think of myself as the man who sells me coffee every day at a Mexican deli in New York. Or I think of myself as the man who delivers my pizza. I have no idea where he's from, but I can perhaps relate to his experience and feel it. Precisely with things like this anti-human ban, I would call it, it is exactly my American side that is most offended.
That was the poet Shada Dayani with her angle on the emotional and cultural front. Her James Baldwin reference was to his oft-repeated line that the story of the Negro in America is the story of America. And here is the Cambridge City Councilor, Nadim Mazin, Illinois-born of Egyptian and American parents. He's found his place in the political struggle. He was elected 4 years ago before he was 30. He's an MIT graduate in mechanical and biomedical engineering. He's a sometime MIT squash coach with a design company and a teaching career. You were a major wheel, Nadim, in the second big Boston protest post-inaugural. What sort of organizing battle are you prepared for?
Well, the battle ahead is going to take place on the local level. I got started because I was amazed that the problems we see on the federal level actually exist very much on the local level everywhere you go.
Meaning?
Lack of real representation, high barriers to entry for us, the people, obfuscation and opacity, lack of accountability, special interests giving to people right before votes, for example, as we saw in the DeVos confirmation.
Hmm.
The fact that this exists at the local level is a problem for the left. On the left, we want to have strong establishments. We heard earlier in the program about the erosion of our kind of civic and political leadership infrastructure. And we want to obviously to reclaim the heyday of winning the presidency, winning states, winning for our ideals, and maybe, as we've heard from prior speakers, even winning towards a greater measure of equity. Maybe even economic benefit on the heels of that. If we want to have these things for all people, we have got to start from the bottom up, and the Republicans did it well. They did it very well, and they did it differently, but we obviously want to track back to that ourselves.
How did you get elected, by the way?
I got elected in 2013 by 6 votes. It was an energetic campaign. We did it by meeting people. You start, you engage a daily practice. You start to get your 4 to 5 people together. And with 4 to 5 people, you can do anything. And in 2015, I won by the most votes out of anyone running for city council. So really staying in the community, having a policy of advocacy and of community engagement and mobilization. It works in the chamber when you're trying to legislate. It works in the reelection because you do it authentically.
Did you beat an old timer or another newbie?
Well, in Cambridge, we're all at large. So a couple of incumbents had lost their seats, and several new people came in at that time.
Okay. Back to the basics here. The precinct-by-precinct organization against a presidential agenda is something brand new in our world. I mean, what's the plan? What's the big strategic idea?
You know, everyone's asking, how do I plug in? We've seen a 25,000-person march that John Robbins at CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, and I put together a couple Sundays ago. You had the 250,000-person march, but then we go home. I think it really starts, as I said, with a daily practice, each person saying, I have 5 minutes or 10 minutes a day, listing out the people who might hark to your call to action. Kind of accounting for people's dependability and vetting one another for who's really in this and who's just going to mobilize when it's time to vote. There's 2 great pools. And then using the people who are dependable to go and collect up to hundreds or thousands of people. Each of us can be worth hundreds or thousands of votes. And I think, indeed, we will be. The fervor now is very strong. We saw it during Occupy, and I think now we're going to reach escape velocity on the progressive left.
Neil Swiety and Aziz Rana are still in the conversation. I just don't want to observe, and maybe you did too, Neil, at the Copley Square demonstration. It was big. It was witty. It was fun. It was hearty. We'll be back. We're staying here. But the striking thing to me was how quickly, in a week, the signs of great variety had shifted out of the identity mode, female gender issues, to deeply felt notions about immigration. There were biblical references. There was a wonderful sign, another Jew against Islamophobia. It struck a deep chord. Can this last? Neil, were you there?
I watched it, and I was struck by the discussion earlier about the antecedents for this, both in this election and prior elections as well. And I would caution against the temptation to think that this is all brand new and that there's been this huge change. I mean, the race that Pat Buchanan was running in 1992, and I know you talked to him recently, was very similar to the Trump campaign. And it just didn't peel up enough of the moderate votes to get people. It didn't hit the way it did, but it gave Bush a scare. And it really was that challenge. And it was the Steve Bannon sort of conservative Catholic close the door behind us mentality that's been there among many immigrant groups in this country from history. And I think the key thing that we connected before, when you talk about Trump and Sanders, and you can't lose sight of that, is the economic argument. I mean, that's what those both guys had, which was the game is rigged and we've got to do something about that. And two completely different characters, but making that same argument. And now the people who voted for Trump are wondering, when they see all the Goldman Sachs people coming in, whether they were sold a bill of goods. But I think they had legitimate issues that were not being addressed by the traditional candidates on there. And that is, I think, what is going to happen here is who's going to address those effectively.
While it's
Nadine, please.
While it's not new, in a way it is new, because in 92, there was a very different ground game apparatus in the local and state legislatures for Republicans on the right. And now I think people on the left can kind of firmly say in fear, oh my goodness, we actually have to mobilize. This isn't just going to go away. There's a potential for a 30-year Supreme Court majority, depending on how things play out. People on the left actually know in a very real and urgent way that they have to change the game, each of us individually, if we're on the left.
Yeah, although just
go ahead.
Oh. I wanted to ask you, what is the prospect of a national ground game around immigration issues against a brand new president?
So that I'm, to be honest, I'm not sure of, but I will say this, which is that this is really, for me, the most politicized I've seen, you know, the American public in general, and especially people that broadly think of themselves as progressive or on the left. I mean, I think it's really noteworthy that a decade ago, the Bush administration implemented a series of policies that were quite destructive of Muslim communities. You know, there's been a lot of talk, for example, about like the Muslim registry and NCRs and individuals that found themselves deported. We have like the mass arrests that took place as part of Pent Bomb right after 9/11. You can go on and on and on. And there was very little organized activism. And it's worth noting the amount of activism that's picked up almost immediately, and the ways in which it's been tied to real grassroots infrastructure. In other words, it's something that's spontaneous. It's occurring on campuses. It's occurring in workplaces across the country. And I think the problem at the present is, you know, to what extent is there a unified national leadership? I mean, this would be where like a strong political party would take the lead, but the Democratic Party's national leadership has frankly been weak. And then the classic institutions of the left, unions, the civil rights movement, sort of classic institutions, they're just not what they once were. And so in a way, you have all of the energy, but you don't have the institutional framework to house it. And that's, I think, going to basically be what's constructed over the next few years. You have the incipient mobilizations through everything from like Occupy to Black Lives Matter to the May Day and like Dreamers work, but we don't have like a framework to place it within.
I'm wondering, Nadim, what handle do you have on the economic reality, which may be the decisive problem in this discontent?
You know, I want to go just back briefly to what was just said. I think it's totally correct that we don't have the establishment at all on the left in the party. You see Donna Brazile as an interim chair, where that has no business happening even on an interim basis. And then you have these state committees that are still held by people who have held positions of power within for years or decades, who are saying, well, we don't know why this happened, but we're certainly not going to stand aside or change the game now, both on the federal level and on the state level. We absolutely have to have hundreds, thousands, as Bernie Sanders said, a grassroots movement of millions of people flooding into these organizations in order to meaningfully change them. On the economic front, my generation and younger are, I think, petrified at the prospect of what was 10 years ago American exceptionalism now turning into, will we be a generation that earns less than our parents? There's been 40 years of wage stagnation. And in Cambridge of all places, we can see that even upper management isn't beating inflation. People are not increasing their real wages. And if you're in the service industry or you're just getting started in your career, you are losing against inflation, often by as much as 10% over 5 years.
And that's central to that. That's where people are looking for are answers for that. And what operatives are going to do is try to peel off segments of the public who are more concerned about that with easy answers on one way or the other. And let's remember that immigration historically has been the issue that has confounded normal political lines. So you had organized labor historically being opposed to robust immigration for bargaining purposes. They were allied with nativists and people for racial issues and discrimination issues who wanted to oppose that. And on the other side, you had people who were big business who liked robust education, immigration, because that was cheap labor. So that is, no one's quite figured out that yet. Right now, what we're seeing is the early piece of this, which is using it as a wedge issue. What we haven't seen yet is the economic argument that's going to both be consistent with American goals and our values that we understand about being a nation of immigrants, and effective in the economic argument for changing people's lives in the stagnation that Nadine was talking about.
My very amateur observation from a totally unscientific sample is that people rejoice at the opportunity to be out in the street and constructively with other like-minded people. That's on the basis of three rallies maybe so far in 3 weeks.
I think that translates very naturally, hopefully, to what we really need to be doing, which is meeting our neighbors out on the streets in this beautiful snow day here, canvassing, meeting people, door knocking, phone banking, the traditional and the online versions, of course, reaching out over social media, mobilizing, learning, exchanging ideals and mobilizing methodologies. All of these things are intrinsic, I think, in many ways to the American experience and to the civic experience.
What is your pitch on the street, Nadim? I'm a young Paul, and what do people say?
Yeah, well, you know, I say I'm a young guy who just got involved a couple of years ago, but already we've been able to make a big difference. You know, I just got in by 6 votes. Your vote makes a difference, but also our advocacy makes a difference. When the bike community comes to City Hall with 1,000-person petition and a rally, and the streets aren't safe, lo and behold, we change something that has been in a holding pattern for years, and that's all new. In from my perspective in Cambridge, we can do that everywhere.
I was going to add something on this, which is, you know, I think the point about these classic cleavages is a really key one, but it's also important to appreciate that, you know, coalition building has always taken place through actual politics, through actual organization mobilizing. That's one of the things I think is also exciting about these protests, that, you know, the labor movement in the 30s and 40s realized that unless you organize African Americans in the South, the idea, the dream of the New Deal was going to get crushed. And that's why you had the move toward things like Operation Dixie and a commitment to racial equality within the CIO. And I think you're already starting to see kind of hints of this, and that's going to have to be the politics down the line, which is how to link these various discrete commitments. So the commitment to social democracy, to providing like basic social goods, like the commitment to anti-racism, the commitment to, you know, an inclusive, immigrant-friendly politics. And I think that's the stuff that's been swirling effectively around the protests because of the target that Trump provides, and it's basically going to be what's built through actual on-the-ground activism over the next few years.
I wonder, Niels Whitey, do we believe this actual picture taking shape of two Americas in confrontation and the media not a principal player?
Well, I think I've seen the opposite on this point. I see the media as being more valuable than ever when people are actually looking for this. The media has been under attack with all this nonsense about fake news. And people are thirsty for fair news that is going to help give them a sense of grounding on where they are in this. I think that was the idea with history, connecting that. So when people talk about unprecedented, you actually know, hey, this is not unprecedented, and where do we go from here? And also to get the sense of when you see these protests right now, I think there's a lot of that has to do with a feeling of powerlessness in this country. I mean, that's what happened when you see a vote that had the popular vote so different on there. People felt powerless and went looking for some action.
Last short word, Councillor Mazin.
Last short word. I hope for a future where journalism gives us a place to take action within and to actually make good on what we're learning and reading and sharing and hating.
We're following the organizers now. Thank you for your role, all of you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Niels Whitey. Thank you, Aziz Rana. And Nadim Mazin. Thanks also to Francis Fukuyama, Shada Dayani, and Hilary Rantisi at the JFK School of Government. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.